the first of many huge stockpiles of oil and gasoline, by gasoline-driven vehicles. At first he did this for purely mercenary reasons, but as the years went by, he found that bringing light to dark places had its own reward. Then others began to trade, others whose motives were by no means as altruistic. This is often the way. Now, in the last part of the 20th century, old style, just about 100 years after the nuke and what had once been known as North America, the descendants of those who had not succumbed to radiation sickness or died by violence at the brutal hands of their fellow men and women look out upon a vastly altered and, for the most part, hideously strange world. To the north lies a cold waste where men clothe themselves in furs the year round. Where once the Great Lakes had been, there is now a huge sullen inland sea, bordered on the northeast and south by a blasted land. From Cape Cod down to South Carolina lies a ruin-choked wasteland to which only now is life slowly returning. But to the north of this seared terrain, New Hampshire, and below it, South Carolina, there exist bustling baronies, ruled by powerful families who have clawed out territory for themselves over a period of 60 years or so. Here, primitive manufacturing industry can be found, a veneer of civilized sophistication, even electric light. But there have, of course, been no advances. Weapons, tools, gadgets, all of these date from the last quarter of the 20th century, either as relics handed down from father to son over three generations and kept in as workable condition as possible, or as loot from the various stockpiles opened up over the years. Where in the South, the rich and evil soup of chemical and biological agents vomited across the landscape, there now exist fetid strontium swamps and near tropical forest, where new and terrible life forms lurk. The Southwest has become a huge tract of simmering hotland, dust bowl territory for the most part, skinned of cacti and even the most primitive forms of vegetation, where 250-mile-per-hour winds hurtle in from the Gulf. And when, by some atmospheric miracle, storm clouds sweep across from the Pacific, it is acid rain that falls, pure acid that can strip a man to the bones in seconds flat. The resculpted West Coast has now calmed down, although it is still volcanic, and far below the Earth's surface and beneath the waves, there are still tremendous natural forces simmering in uneasy captivity. Stark fjords stab into the mountainous coastline to the north, steaming lagoons lie to the south. In the heartland of this huge country, there are dramatic changes. The Great Salt Lake, already rising dangerously in the late 20th century, has extended its bounds because of quake subsidence at the Wasatch Fault and the years-long drenchings caused by intense climatic disturbance. It now covers nearly 15,000 square miles and is roughly the area of the ancient Lake Bonneville of more than 10,000 years ago. Everywhere there are ruined cities, overgrown with noxious vegetation, where people of a kind still live and battle for survival and supremacy among the brooding tree and undergrowth-choked urban canyons. A new lake has formed in what was once Washington State. New deserts have appeared. The Badlands are even worse. Large areas of the country lie under an umbrella of dust and debris that clings to the atmosphere in strange forms. In some places is a boiling, red-scarred belt of cloud maybe a mile thick. In others is a dense blanket of toxic smog and floating nuclear junk. A coverlet of destruction, mantling a land of doom. Little wonder, then, that the entire continent, north to south, east to west, coast to coast, is known to those who inhabit it as Deathlands. Three generations have now passed since the nuke. Time enough for bizarre, mutated life forms to have developed, both human and animal. In some mutants, the genetic codes have become completely scrambled, giving life to monstrous beings, men and women with hideous deformities. In others, the arrangement has been far more subtle. Extrasensory perception and the weird ability to see the immediate future are two of the special talents typically possessed by certain mutants. In all the coastal baronies, mutants are feared and hated. In some, they are hunted down and ruthlessly exterminated. Small groups of muties have fled up to the far northeast, to where Old Maine bordered Old New Brunswick. There are no customs houses now, Here, amid the cool, dark pine and larch woods, largely untouched by radiation showers, they have integrated with the forest people, isolated and secretive folk who rarely travel. Far more roam the central Deathlands, where it's still pretty much a free-for-all society. There is no interest at all in what goes on in the rest of the world. Why should there be? Here is what matters. And now. A fight for survival in what is still a hostile and deadly environment. A grim world of danger and sudden death and teeming horrors from which there seems to be no escape. And yet, strange stories have been handed down from one generation to the next. Wild hints circulate. It is said that the old-time scientists made certain discoveries back before the nuke. Bizarre and sensational discoveries that were never made public. It is rumored that there are awesome secrets still to be uncovered in the Deathlands. Deep-level redoubts stuffed with breathtaking scientific marvels, fabulous technological treasure troves. It is even whispered that there is an escape route, that somewhere beyond the Deathlands there lies a land of lost happiness. Absurd, of course. Irrational. A foolishly nostalgic dream conjured up to compensate for living a life of horror in a land of death. Or is it? Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Azelford, Colleen Delaney, Timberlee Chanel, Kate Torrey, Michael Replogle, Christopher Graybill, Christopher Walker, Thomas Penny, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands Number 1, Pilgrimage to Hell. Reacher could smell blood. It was there in his nostrils, a coppery odor, redolent of death and horror. Then it was gone. It had lasted a microsecond, as it always did, and then there was nothing there at all but the memory of it. That, and the icy chill stroking his spine like skeletal fingers, and the blood-red haze that clouded his mind. He shivered, clutched at his brow. Death was ahead. The warning had been given. The weird antennae of his psyche had fingered the future, told him of blood and destruction. But the how and the why of it, the exact where and when, were never granted. Not to him. Reacher was not a true doomseer. Exact details were denied him. He could only perceive the psychic smell of it. And he knew it would be soon. Very soon. There was nothing he could do about it. Nothing on earth he could do to stop it.
Hey, the mutie's got something. He's picking something up.
Reacher felt a hand shake him roughly on the shoulder. It broke his concentration, scattered the scarlet fog in his mind. He stumbled forward, dropped to his knees, his hands scraping rock and sharp-edged stones at the side of the old tarmac road.
Come on, come on! On your feet, mutie! What is it? What are you seeing? Where's the danger coming from?
Still half-dazed from the effects of the sudden mind zap, Reacher struggled to his feet, blinking his eyes rapidly. He stared around him as though seeing the terrain, his surroundings, for the first time, as though waking up from a dream. A cliff face rose up sheer from the side of the road on his left, its summit lost in the hovering gloom that was split every few seconds by fierce, jagged traceries of lightning darting surreally about the sky. To his right, beyond the road and the bush-matted strip of verge, was the lip of the gorge that plunged heart-stoppingly down to the river racing far below. Ahead was the road, rutted and cracked and potholed, unused for generations, devastated by the angry elements that feuded constantly day and night in these blasted and forsaken mountains, winding steeply, disappearing around craggy bends. Behind, the road snaked downward to the river, through grim foothills, past Sick Forest and Leprous Meadow, out to an even grimmer plain. Reacher wiped an arm across his face, leaned groggily against the black granite of the sheer cliff, stared sullenly at the three men facing him. First was McCandless, always first, the leader, the guy who had brought them together, the guy who had succeeded where everyone else, every mother's son over the past three or four decades, had failed. That was his boast. Black-bearded, scarred, glaring-eyed, hulking in his furs. McCandless was a brute schemer who let nothing get in his way. He wanted power, and he bulldozed opponents, anyone who acted or even thought differently. Then Rogan, McCandless's sidekick. Tall, craggy, stupid-faced, and stupid-brained, but handy with his shooter. That had to be admitted. Reacher had seen how handy Rogan could be back in Moxon, when the tall, pea-brained man had shot a guy's nose away. Rogan hadn't liked the way the guy had been bad-mouthing McCandless, calling him crazy for even thinking of heading up into the Dark Hills. Rogan had shot the tip of the guy's nose off. One slug, swiftly done, almost without thinking about it. Last Reacher knew, the guy was still alive. And why not? All Rogan had done was blow his snout away. Nothing to it. Then there was Kurt. Kurt was okay. Solidly built, stocky, thick reddish-brown hair, watchful eyes. Nothing seemed to worry Kurt. He took things as they came, did the best he could in a bad situation. He, too, was handy with his gun, handier than Rogan and McCandless put together. Which was why he was here on this rutted road that snaked blindly higher and higher into the Dark Hills. McCandless didn't care much for Kurt, but he cared a lot about the way he handled a gun. Reacher wearily pushed himself away from the rock face.
Reacher, damn it! What the hell do you see?
Hang on a minute, McCandless.
Reacher, I'm gonna cut your heart out unless you tell us what you've seen.
I don't see anything, McCandless. You know that. I ain't a doomy. I just smell it.
I ought to get myself a doomy, Reacher. You ain't paying your way.
You'd never have got a doomy, McCandless. You know that, too. Ain't too many of them guys around. And most of them keep dark what they got.
Miserable mutie. You're all the same. Ain't human and ain't worth shit.
Rogan cringed back as McCandless suddenly turned on him. The leader lashed a gloved fist across Rogan's face. Rogan staggered back toward the precipice, then tripped, sprawling only inches away from the drop. He glared up at McCandless with red-rimmed eyes. Around them, the wind howled like a dead soul racked in chilly hell. Lightning flickered crazily. The air seemed charged with electricity. Even though the wind was a cold and icy blast, the atmosphere was heavy, muggy. Reacher felt his bones had been somehow turned to lead. His body was clammy with sweat under the thick fur garments, even as the wind cut at his exposed face like a keen-bladed knife. Reacher watched Rogan crawl away from the chasm and scramble to his feet. Rogan didn't look at McCandless. He was breathing heavily, fingering his face where the bulky man had struck him. Reacher didn't need his uncanny power to tell him that danger threatened now. Any fool could see that an explosion was only minutes away. But that was not what Reacher had smelled seconds before. He did not know what had triggered off his psychic alarm, but it was definitely not Rogan going berserk or McCandless cutting loose just for the hell of it. McCandless was a psychopath, almost totally unstable. He'd proven that the day he reduced their group from 5 to 4. A flash of near-perfect memory came over Reacher, another of his unbidden talents. He saw the scene again, played out in an instant in his mind's eye.
You got something to say about the plan, Denning?
Well, yeah, McCandless. I'm just thinking that there might be a way into the mountains other than this road. And if there is, it's got to be the smarter route to take.
Smarter, huh?
Sure. I'm figuring that the obvious course of action might get us into needless danger. The road's too open. Cover's negligible, from what I can see. We got no idea what's waiting out there, out of sight.
What's your figures out there?
Muties, cannies, anything could be up there. On the road, we're an easy target. Maybe that's why no one's ever returned from the Dark Hills before, out of all the folks that's tried to. I'm just saying we should try another route, and if we can't find one, then we take the road.
Huh. Interesting idea.
Then McCandless had simply pulled out his dented, much-used .45 automatic and put a soft nose into Denning's face, blowing the rear of his skull out in a spray of blood and pinkish-gray matter.
Mouthy motherfucker.
Reacher experienced it again as McCandless and Rogan divided up the contents of Denning's backpack, taking gun, ammo, food, and other essentials. Then the party had moved on. No one had argued. Rogan hadn't argued because he knew he'd be sharing the spoils. Wise man. Offing Denning meant at the end of the day that there was one less mouth to feed, one less person to share in the possible treasure at the end of the trail. The fact that it also meant they had one less gunman to blow away attackers did not necessarily occur to him. Kurt had not argued because he was phlegmatic by nature. He knew he would not get a share of Denning's leavings because he was a hired gun, a blaster pure and simple. Sure, he'd get a share of whatever they found, if anything, up in the hills. But other than that, forget it. He just took orders from McCandless, kept his eyes open for danger, and hoped for the best. Reacher certainly had not argued. He was a survivor. The main reason he'd survived to the age of 30, give or take a year or three, was that he never argued with anyone. Especially not with guys who held guns and called the shots. In any case, his peculiar talent, born out of a blind stew of scrambled genes somewhere back along a kin line a century before, was invaluable to McCandless, however much the bulky man might rage and fume, and unless he went stark out of his mind, Reacher would survive yet. Reacher snapped out of his memory-induced instant, as he suddenly thought that the way things were going, the way madness seemed to be encroaching on them all, there was a damned good chance McCandless would go stark out of his mind.
So, Reacher, you're reminding me I ain't got me a doomy, I got me a sensor? Well, why did I get me a sensor, Reacher? You want to remind me of that? To sniff out trouble, that's why. And what was the deal? The deal was this sensor'd get food and a share of the good stuff when we hit it. That was the bargain, just so long as he worked his passage. So what did you see, Reacher?
Reacher was on the verge of repeating that he hadn't seen anything, that he'd made it perfectly clear to McCandless right at the start that he couldn't see anything, that he never would see anything, that it was a sheer physical impossibility for him to see anything. And then he thought, split second swiftly, the hell with it. A quibble like that would get him a slug in the skull. Right now, McCandless was not interested in wordplay. Reacher gestured up the road.
There, somewhere up there, waiting for us.
Right! What?
Reacher tapped his forehead lightly, not looking at McCandless or the other two. Trying to explain to men like these was always difficult, and in any case, Reacher himself had no real idea why he was the way he was. It was relatively easy to accept the physical aspects of genetic mutation, why some mutants had no mouths, for instance, or three eyes, or scales, or pachydermatous skin, especially these days. Those who knew about these matters said that the full effects of the nuke were only just beginning to come to the surface. But how in hell did you explain something that went on in the mind? Something that was not at all tangible. Something extrasensory. Something that had to do with the emotions. At least that was the way Reacher figured it, if he thought about it at all, which wasn't very often. There were other more pressing problems to think about and try to cope with in this world. Like a lot of muties, Reacher accepted he was different and kept his head down. There was no percentage in making waves. Again, the guys who knew about these things had actually figured out a very strange scenario. They said that maybe in another two or three generations, if there was anyone left at all in this hell world, it could be that mutants would exceed normals, that in fact it would be the muties who were the norms muties. Reacher tried not to think about it, although it gave him a secret twinge of pleasure and satisfaction.
Dunno, all I get's an impression. That's all I ever get, an impression in my mind. Ain't nothing physical, McCandless, but it's never wrong. Somewhere up the road we got trouble. Could be us, could be guys waiting for us. Could be a rock slide, I don't know. But it's there, and I'm warning you. We have to tread careful, real careful.
Shit! You're telling me nothing! We gotta tread real careful where?
I'm warning you. This is special, whatever it is. This is death.
And it's gonna happen no matter what?
It ain't as simple as that. Yeah, it's gonna happen, whatever. Doesn't necessarily mean it's gonna happen to us.
You're never wrong, huh?
99%.
Well, okay, that's good enough, Reacher, you old mutie. Good job. I'm feeling lucky today. That 1% is riding for me. We're gonna get us the loot and we're all gonna be kings of the mountain. Ain't that right, Rogan?
Yeah, sure is, boss.
What about the blaster? What do you think, Kurt? We riding lucky?
Kurt's face was expressionless, a mask. He was bitterly regretting this whole venture. He had a strong feeling, an unshakable feeling, that they were all going to wind up dead. Nastily. Or if not quite that, some disaster was heading their way, with no reprieve. This feeling had been building up inside him for 3 days. It had actually started about 2 seconds after McCandless had first clapped him on the shoulder on the dusty drag outside Joe's Bites in Main Street Moxon and offered him the blaster's job for an eighth share in whatever they found in the darks. It was an insane proposition, and McCandless had an insane reputation. The only reason Kurt had agreed to it, instantly and without thinking about it much at all, was that the night before he'd bucked one of Jordan Teague's captains, felled him to the floor in the tawdry casino in the center of the strip, and he was already making panic plans to get out of Moxon fast. The only snag was, the next land wagon train wasn't scheduled to leave for at least a week. Kurt did not have the cash or even the creds to buy himself some wheels, and the necessary amount of fuel that would take him to the next main center of population 250 kilometers to the south. The fact that Teague's captain, an ugly son of a bitch with a walleye named Hajik, had been cheating Kurt, and Kurt had spotted it, made no difference. You didn't screw around with a member of what passed for the law in Jordan Teague's bailiwick. Jordan Teague didn't like it, and Jordan Teague had peculiar ideas on how to avenge insults in his own special brand of law. Kurt had spent most of the night shitting himself in a cross-the-tracks cat house, a real sleaze pit not even the grossest of Teague's minions would touch. Eventually, he had sneaked out to get some food at Joe's and run into McCandless. McCandless was in a hurry, a hell of a hurry. He was heading out into the Deathlands there and then. The guy he'd already hired as blaster had thought better of it and disappeared, and Kurt didn't blame him. The very idea of venturing into the Dark Hills was clearly the product of a diseased imagination, and that about summed up McCandless's mind. Even Jordan Teague had never contemplated an expedition into the Darks. Despite the possibility that something weird and wonderful could be hidden among those brooding peaks, the fact was that over the years, many had gone looking for it, and only one had ever returned. Kurt remembered that return very clearly. He had good reason to remember it, that incident nearly 2 decades earlier. He remembered a crazed, babbling wreck of a human being, brain-fried, wild-eyed, clothes in rags and tatters, crawling toward him along the dusty apology for a once-busy blacktop. Dolfo Kaler. A man with creds in store, real estate, a power in the land. Or as much of a power as one could ever be under the gross shadow of Jordan Teague. Certainly more power than most in Teague's primitive gold-based mini-empire. He had his own satraps, his own bully boys, a fleet of land wagons, a few good trade routes, mainly to the east, and fuel alcohol supplies, if not exactly on tap, at least regular. Teague let him be. Kaler had solid contacts in the east, some kind of kin who would only deal with him. Teague knew that if he deeped Kaler, those contacts would be lost. He kept an eye on Kaler, just in case Kaler started to dream of empire, but otherwise left him alone. There was a wary truce between the two men. But the fact was that Kaler was not greedy for what Teague had. He watched his back when Teague was around, but otherwise he was not involved with the man. He had other dreams, sparked by whispers that nagged at his brain. Insistent, ghostly murmurs that urged him to think the unthinkable. Somewhere up in that vast range of hills that they called the Darks was something. Treasure, they said, a fantastic, unbelievable hoard just sitting there, just waiting for a strong man to claim it. That was what was said. That was what had been whispered for a generation. 2 generations, more. Maybe going right back to the nuke. Maybe going back to before the nuke. So there had to be something there. It was a hand-me-down tale, a story embedded deep in the recent folk memory. Kaler, a sensible man, discounted stories of gold, jewels, fine raiments, all that stuff. It was so much crap, so much useless crap. Who needed it? So, okay, Jordan Teague was starting to create an economy, a lifestyle on the gold he was digging out of the seams exposed by the nuke, forgotten through the chill, just like everything had been forgotten, and rediscovered only a few years back. Teague was moving the stuff very gingerly to the east, and guys out there were sniffing at it, pondering its possibilities, wondering if it would do them any good. And maybe in another 10 years, gold would be back in fashion. But 10 years was a long time. And right now, the only worthwhile way of doing things was barter, trade, and credit. Sure, coin was coming back. It was useful. But thus far, it sure as hell didn't beat fresh food, canned food, animals, as long as they were reasonably pure, and weapons and ammo. Especially, it didn't beat ammo. And that was what Dolfo Kaler figured was up there in the darks. No fairy tale hoard of goodies, but a stockpile, a major stockpile, maybe far bigger than any of the ones that had been unearthed so far. Anybody who was anybody now knew that, before the nuke, the government of the day, a government that had ruled the whole land north to south, west to east, had been rumored to have squirreled away stuff in deep-cast ferro-concrete bunkers. Now it was an established fact. Some had been discovered, opened up. There was a guy who called himself the Trader who'd found two and turned them into a business. He'd started off by chugging around the Deathlands in steam trucks a couple of years before, but now he was using gasoline. Gasoline. And trading guns in every direction. He was heavily weaponed himself, too, as guys who tried to hijack him had discovered to their cost. The shit was there if you could find it. But from what Dolfo Kaler had learned, the stockpiles found up to now were small. The nagging suspicion he had was that if there really was something up in the darks, and if it was a stockpile, it was a big one. And that was why he didn't give a fart about Jordan Teague's little fiefdom. If what he suspected was true, and if he could get his hands on it, he could turn himself into king of the known world. Dolfo Kaler's mind lovingly dwelt on boxes of guns in their original greased wraps, pristine fresh, never used. Crates of grenades, heavy armament, trucks, tanks, oceans of oil, power. So he went out. He took 50 men, all of them hand-picked from his own garrison, mixed in with others from his contacts in the east. Hard-bitten dog soldiers. Didn't give a nuke's hot ass about anything or anyone. It was a mighty expedition. Seeing it, even Jordan Teague got broody. But then, it had to be a mighty expedition, because others had heard the summons, the siren call that drifted into men's minds from the darks. Others had hit the road on the 100-click or so journey under the sulfuric skies, across the parched earth, through the leprous forests that grew around the foothills of the darks. And none had ever come back. Which meant there must have been a strong contingent of maniacal muties barring the way to it. Dolfo Kaler knew how to deal with crazies. Blow 'em away. He bartered, he finagled, he called in every long-term debt he had out. And in the end, every man jack of his team had an automatic rifle of some description and a stack of rounds. He also acquired 7 MGs, 4 flamethrowers, and a supply of precious fuel and 2 bazookas, not to mention a box of grenades and a launcher. And then he set out. There were 6 big steam trucks, snorting and grinding and belching black smoke, and they shifted but one fine spring morning when the skies were not as yellow as usual and a hazy red fireball of a sun was doing pretty well and had struggled to penetrate the haze. There must have been half of Moxon on the edge of town to see them off, waving crudely fashioned flags and whooping and hollering fit to burst. Maybe 3,000 souls to watch the biggest thing to happen to the town in decades. Kurt remembered it. He remembered it very well. It had happened on his birthday, and his Ma and Pa had taken him to see the cavalcade as a birthday treat. Kurt remembered yelling with the rest of them. He didn't really know what he was yelling for, except that just seeing those huge lumbering steam trucks lurching out of town was exciting enough. The most exciting thing that had ever happened to him. And the guys in the trucks yelling too, caught up in the glamour of it all, waving their pieces above their heads, all clearly itching to fire a few shots to finish the celebration off, but not daring to because ammo was ammo then, and you didn't waste one single round of it. And Kurt also remembered the payoff. The horror of that day, maybe 4 months later, with the late summer sun blistering down through the haze, a light wind whipping up the dust into the heavy air in thin spirals.
Fog! The fog!
And the single raggedy man crawling toward him, blind eyes staring out of a gaunt and blackened face, one desiccated hand clawing and twitching in the air like a mummified insect come to dreadful life. a human skeleton, his clothes in rags and tatters, inching his way laboriously along the ruined blacktop, muttering and mumbling to himself as his knee